while there's no way to exactly know where the remaining count will break, as of now, I'm cautiously optimistic.
National Democrats keep a close eye on Alaska's U.S. Senate race. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, the 13th of November. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Governor Palin looks ahead in a Florida speech.
We are now the minority party, but let us resolve not to become the negative party.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alaska Conservation Solutions, providing ways to measure your carbon footprint and reduce your energy consumption at AlaskaConservationSolutions.com.
The Division of Elections will begin counting more than 40,000 remaining absentee early and question ballots tomorrow, working through next Tuesday to clear up the large backlog still pending for this year's general election. Those final results will also give the 2008 election the Alaska record for attracting the largest number of voters to the polls, and it will closely approach the highest percentage of voters. Both those records were set in 2004. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
The votes that still have to be counted will determine who will represent the state in the U.S. Senate next year. In the new results posted yesterday, Anchorage Mayor Mark Begich came from a 3,200-vote deficit to an 800-vote lead over 40-year veteran Senator Ted Stevens. Begich says with new results coming until Tuesday of next week, it's too early to claim victory.
Things feel good. We're optimistic, but very cautious about the situation we're at right now. But it feels like the groundwork we did and the hard work we did on the field and the early get out the vote is starting to pay off.
Begich encouraged his supporters to take advantage of Alaska's early voting option. And the payoff came when early votes cast in the final 5 days of the campaign, but not counted on Election Day, gave him a boost of 4,000 ballots. Randy Reedrick is chair of the state Republican Party. He says he knew the first count of early ballots would deliver a blow to Senator Stevens, but he's confident the final numbers will give the incumbent a win.
We're now basically through counting the Democrat strongholds across the state. So I view this as probably the low watermark, and we'll build from here to a victory to have Senator Ted back in Washington.
Begich says he isn't taking anything for granted until the counting is complete.
We look at a couple good indicators. You know, we beat Senator Stevens on the military basis, which I think was a clear sign that things have changed. In rural Alaska, like Bethel, we almost over 2-1 we beat him. Dillingham, Kotzebue, Nome, Barrow, all these areas we did significantly well in. We beat him in all locations that showed that his core support is no longer as it used to be. But at the end of the day, there's still 35,000 more votes to be counted, and we're very cautious about where those come from, and we'll know better Friday when they count probably 40 to 50% of those, maybe more.
The ballots already counted have come close to sealing the race between Congressman Don Young and Democratic challenger Ethan Berkowitz. Although Berkowitz closed the gap between the two candidates, Young still has a 15,000-vote lead. Neither Young nor Berkowitz would comment on the results. Regional offices in Juneau, Wasilla, Fairbanks, and Nome will begin counting Friday. The Anchorage office will not count again until next Tuesday. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
The Stevens-Begich race is being watched closely in Washington, where Republicans and Democrats are eager to see the seat fall into their camp. The chairman of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, Senator Charles Schumer of New York, says he's cautiously optimistic Begich will win the Alaska race. The committee is the largest organization dedicated to getting Democrats elected to the Senate. It poured more than $1 million into Alaskan ads that criticized Stevens during the final weeks of the campaign. Schumer says everyone in Washington is waiting to see the rest of the ballots tallied.
I don't want to make any predictions before the votes are counted, but winning the early and absentee vote was a major focus of the Begich campaign and our field program, and the returns yesterday showed that the strategy is paying off.
Schumer says of the absentee and early return ballots counted so far, more were cast for Begich, giving Democrats hope that the remaining ballots will also lean toward their candidate.
We are happy with the results we saw yesterday, And while there's no way to exactly know where the remaining count will break, as of now, I'm cautiously optimistic that we will win this race.
Schumer and his colleagues are watching three Senate races still in play. In addition to Alaska, seats in Minnesota and Georgia are too close to call. In Minnesota, a recount is underway, and Georgia is preparing for a runoff election on December 2nd. So far, Democrats have won 57 seats in the Senate. If all three of the seats still up for grabs fall to the Democrats, they would have 60 seats, a filibuster-proof majority. Schumer says that's possible, but unlikely. In state legislative races, the outcome of six House seats and one Senate seat were too close to call on Election Day, but yesterday's additional ballot count didn't change any of those results. The same candidates are still in the lead. KSKA's Len Anderson has this look at the Anchorage area races, including one that now appears headed to court.
In the election night tally, District 19 Republican incumbent Bob Roses trailed his Democrat challenger Pete Peterson by 138 votes. The Muldoon representative then based his hopes for a second term on the early absentee and challenged ballots. But yesterday morning, the early votes went against him.
It looks like it's over for me, but, you know, it's not over till it's over, so we just never know what's going to happen. I don't know how many votes are out there yet that are still coming in, and I don't know how many votes we got on the question ballots.
Lewis found little comfort in his strong showing against an incumbent opponent.
Being close in a political race doesn't really count. I don't take that as a compliment. Winning is a compliment.
In the third close Anchorage House race, Democrat Chris Tuck increased his lead over Republican Ron Jordan from 158 to a more comfortable 225. But Tuck's claim on the district, formerly held by Republican Ralph Samuels, now faces a legal hurdle. Yesterday, the Republican Party filed suit against the Division of Elections and the Democratic Party for allowing Tuck to use a name other than the one found on his birth certificate. During the campaign, the party formally asked the Division of Elections to remove Tuck as a candidate because his legal last name was Mestis, and that in some legal situations, such as in court and with his PFD, Tuck continued to use Mestis. The division rejected the party's charges. Republican Party Chair Randy Riedrich explained his party's basis for its suit against the Division of Elections.
They didn't research his original registration. They looked at his registration and said, well, that inaccuracy matches the inaccuracy on his filing, and therefore he's okay. Two, less than properly done documents, two wrongs do not make a right. And for that reason, we filed the action against the division for them to go back, straighten up their act.
Division Director Fanumiai said when she considered the original protest, she found no precedent and so followed what seemed to her the most logical course.
Well, I couldn't find anything in election code that would say to the contrary. He registered to vote. He filled out a voter registration form properly. He is a registered voter in the state of Alaska by the name of Chris Tuck. And based on that information, that was how I based my ruling.
Tuck says that his biological father abandoned the family before he was born. And since he was a small boy growing up in Anchorage, he's used his stepfather's name. It's the name he used during his schooling, as an electrician, as a voter, as a school board member, and as a legislative candidate. In essence, he says, it's the name people, including the voters, know him by. Tuck himself is not included in the lawsuit. This is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, environmentalists anticipate a new administration in the White House.
This will translate into improved protections for America's treasured places and a new lease on life for species in decline.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing personal attention from people who live and work right here in Alaska. Wells Fargo, the next stage. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska.
Governor Sarah Palin was back in the national spotlight today at the Republican Governors Association meeting in Miami. She first took questions from reporters at a press conference that lasted only 4 minutes. Palin then gave a speech to the assembled governors. She began by summing up the last few months.
I very briefly expanded my wardrobe. I made a few speeches, met a few VIPs, including those who really impact society, like Tina Fey. And aside from that, it was pretty much same old since we last gathered.
Palin spent several minutes reflecting on her failed bid for the vice presidency with running mate John McCain. She said she was proud to have shared the Republican ticket with the senator, calling it the honor of a lifetime. Despite big losses in last week's election, Palin told the Republican governors their party would rise to fight again.
We are now the minority party, but let us resolve not to become the negative party, too eager to find fault or unwilling to help in this time of crisis and war. Losing an election does not have to mean losing our way. And for governors, the way forward leads through our own state capitals in reforms that we will carry on or begin anew.
Palin has soaked up a lot of attention from the media this week. She has appeared on CNN's Larry King Live, NBC's Today Show, and Fox News. Today's press conference and speech were broadcast on C-SPAN. Palin hasn't commented much on her plans for the next general election in 2012, but she hasn't ruled out seeking the presidency. The country's leading wildlife protection groups weighed in today on what they hope to see from an Obama presidency. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, activists concerned about global warming, endangered species, and public lands are optimistic that the new president and the new Congress will hear their voices.
Betsy Loyless, the National Audubon Society's senior vice president, sums up how many conservationists feel.
Last week's election ushered in a new era of hope for our environment and the people, birds, and other wildlife that depend on it. 8 dismal years of environmental abuse and neglect are now coming to an end.
Loyless says her group hopes President-elect Obama and the Democratic-led Congress will bring fundamental change.
This will translate into improved protections for America's treasured places and a new lease on life for species in decline. The days of secret task forces and backroom deals with polluters are over.
Loyless joined with representatives of Defenders of Wildlife, the Wilderness Society, and the National Wildlife Federation Thursday to weigh in on their priorities. They include balancing energy production with protection of lands, water, and animals, getting serious about combating global warming, and dedicating more federal funds to conservation. They hope that by speaking with a unified voice and by presenting their goals early, they'll gain traction. The Audubon Society's legislative director, Mike Dalton, says he's expecting to see changes in environmental policy as soon as Senator Obama becomes president.
There have been indications from the transition team that there are plans for aggressive use of executive orders early in the administration to show that fundamental change is here.
Dalton says that could mean evaluating where oil drilling is allowed and how it's done. But conservationists say they realize other priorities will take the national spotlight, especially the economy, job losses, and the housing market. John Kostiak with the National Wildlife Federation says tackling the economy can mesh with environmental priorities.
That's good news, actually, for those of us who are working on climate change and the related impacts on natural resources, because there are enormous investment opportunities that are awaiting people ready to get to work, both in terms of creating a green jobs economy, but also on natural resources and environmental restoration projects, which are proven winners for helping re-stimulate the economy.
Many of the recent big battles in conservation have centered in the Arctic, with the polar bear as its star. In May, the polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act, but the Bush administration said that isn't a reason to regulate greenhouse gases. It also said the threat to polar bears is not from oil and gas development. Many conservationists say the threatened listing is toothless without some change in development policies near the bear's habitat and greenhouse gas emissions. Kostiak, with the National Wildlife Federation, says he hopes to see areas designated as critical habitat for the polar bear.
you know, those are the same areas that have been targeted by the Bush administration for oil and gas development and exploration. So it will be a crucial time for this administration to really break from the past policies of favoring the oil and gas industry over the needs of wildlife and people.
The state of Alaska has sued to fight listing the polar bear. State officials fear it will harm oil and gas development. Kostiak says working to protect polar bears doesn't mean all development has to stop, but he does hope to see major changes.
If you look at the history of the Endangered Species Act, it virtually never grinds development to a halt. It typically creates a process where scientists can make recommendations and ultimately policymakers make judgments about how to move forward with development in a responsible way. So I would predict that it would be highly unlikely that the polar bear listing would shut down all oil and gas development across the polar bear's range, but that it would have some impact on the location and timing of that development, certainly.
The dialogue conservationists are having is far different than it was even a couple months ago when Democrats were making concessions to allow for more offshore drilling. But as fuel prices go down and the Bush administration's days dwindle, environmentalists and wildlife advocates hope to take a leading role in national policy. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
World oil prices have been falling in recent months, but Southeast Alaska Native leaders say reducing villages' dependence on diesel fuel is still an urgent priority. As KTOO's John Ryan reports, the Southeast Alaska Native Summit is now underway in Juneau, and the focus is renewable energy.
About 100 Native leaders and energy experts are meeting in Juneau's Alaska Native Brotherhood Hall. Tlingit Haida Central Council President Bill Martin says without affordable energy, there can be no economic development for Native communities. Senator Albert Kukesh of Angoon says this year's cash rebates from the state provided only temporary relief to a long-term problem. The $1,200 resource rebates also bypassed any Alaskans who did not qualify for a permanent fund dividend.
Even though the barrel of oil has dropped right now, we're below $60 a gallon, it'll go up again. There's going to be a need for fossil fuels, and it's going to go up. We need to get to a point where we're all on hydro in Southeast Alaska.
Kukesh says high energy costs have forced people to move away from their villages. Several Native leaders say this year's unusually large permanent fund dividend, with the added $1,200 rebate, has cut both ways for Native villages. The cash infusion helped some people keep the lights on. It also enabled some villagers to leave their villages for better economic prospects elsewhere. Terry Peel is a carver and retired commercial fisherman from Heidelberg.
My daughter took her and her children, and off to Hawaii they went. And I'm saying, oh my goodness, you know, I don't want to see my family out in Hawaii. I want them to find ways to fix things in the community and say, you know, there's other ways we can do this.
Peel says fuel prices haven't gone down at all for people in Heidelberg, despite the drop in prices elsewhere. The state of Alaska is currently evaluating 230 applications from local governments and utilities to develop local renewable energy. But new hydropower plants or wind farms would take years to develop. Russell Heath of the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council told the summit that improving energy efficiency is the fastest way to lower energy costs. For more immediate assistance, the Sea Alaska Native Corporation has expanded its free firewood program to include both shareholders and anyone else living in affected villages. The Southeast Alaska Native Summit continues through Friday and is open to the public. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Northern Air Cargo, with scheduled flights to 16 destinations throughout Alaska every week. Northern Air Cargo, building strong relationships with the communities they serve.
Last month, after a lengthy process that began in 2002, the Environmental Protection Agency transferred authority to oversee and implement the Federal Clean Water Act permitting program, known as the National Pollution Elimination System, or NPDES, to the State Department of Environmental Conservation. NPDES aims to control water pollution through regulation of industrial and municipal entities that discharge materials directly into surface waters. Environmental and conservation organizations have opposed the change, fearing a pro-development state administration will favor industry over community concerns for clean water. Bob Shavelson with Cook Inlet Keeper says one big issue is the state's loser pays law, which mandates that those challenging a permit must pay the court costs if they lose.
And so that has a real chilling effect, because when you're talking about permitting, you're not only talking about agency lawyers and the state's lawyers, but you always have a large corporation intervening with a whole host of well-paid lawyers. So you can be looking at hundreds of thousands of dollars in legal fees if you don't like the permit that was negotiated by the industry and the agency behind closed doors.
DEC Water Division Director Lynn Kent says it's true the state has the loser pays law, but she says a court rule helps make sure that that doesn't deter appeals.
They basically have a rule that says you need to consider, if you're going to award fees to the prevailing party, whether or not that's going to have a chilling effect on other potential litigants in the future. And so we think that our laws have already addressed that concern about whether or not people might become reluctant to appeal a permit.
Tribes have also opposed the transfer, fearing the loss of government-to-government consultation that the federal government must adhere to, but the state does not. The Chiryung Tribe of Dillingham area is one of those tribes concerned with projects like the proposed Pebble Mine. Chiryung Tribal Administrator Dorothy Larson says protection is more in line with their ideology of caring for the area's renewable resources.
I think there's a discrepancy there in the goal of each of the agencies. That the Environmental Protection Agency, of course, I think its name says everything, and that is where our support would lie, too, is in the protection. So we just have a concern that there is a difference in philosophy, a difference in purpose, and it is not, we believe, going to match our priority of making sure the land is protected.
Larson says she believes the EPA must still respond to tribal concerns, even if the state has primacy for NPDES permitting. The DEC's Kent acknowledges that the EPA does still have a trust responsibility with the state's tribes.
So if the tribes at any point in time believe that the state is prepared to issue a permit that doesn't comply with the Federal Clean Water Act, they can certainly request consultation with EPA. EPA has the authority to object to any permit that the state wants to issue, and we're actually barred from issuing that permit until the objection is resolved. So there's still an avenue for the tribes to work with EPA, and we think there's a very robust opportunity for tribes to work with us on the permitting.
Cook Inlet Keepers' Bob Shavelson says the move toward the state gaining primacy began during what he calls protection rollbacks during the Murkowski administration under then DEC Commissioner Ernesta Ballard. Shavelson says, like Ballard, who came from and returned to industry work for Weyerhaeuser after her tenure at DEC, there are industry connections that worry him.
You can look right now at our cabinet positions. Larry Hardick, who's the head of DEC, he's a straight shooter. He's a good guy, but he's been a mining industry lawyer for many years. You can look at Tom Irwin, again, a good guy, a straight shooter, but he's been a mining executive. So these are the people that we have at our Department of Environmental Conservation and Department of Natural Resources, and they're making the decisions and making the rules.
Alaska is the 46th state to gain oversight of the program. Kent says DEC began gearing up for the change in 2005 when the legislature passed Senate Bill 110 and approved an increase of $1.7 million and 14 new positions for DEC to address permitting and compliance. She says total staff within the division dedicated to all facets of the program will be 43, with a budget of around $5 million. She says EPA had 18 staff working on Alaska permits in the past, but she says there is currently a backlog in the state of new and renewal applications. Federal marshals have seized the fish processing barge Atlantis, currently moored in Ketchikan. KRBD's Jay Marble has this report.
According to court papers, the Atlantis, a 200-foot-long, 60-foot-wide processing barge, is now subject to the jurisdiction of the court. In other words, the barge has been seized. Atlantis is owned by a limited liability corporation called Astoria Seafoods. Representatives of Astoria Seafoods have, in the past, negotiated leases with the city of Craig, allowing the Atlantis to moor at city-owned docks. At one point, the city of Craig was given a check to pay for the lease. The business name on the check was Sussex in Alaska. In court papers, Astoria Seafoods LLC is named as the defendant. Cossex in Alaska is also mentioned in the court papers. The plaintiffs in the case are listed as David and Jan McClinton of Washington State. They made two loans to Astoria Seafoods, adding up to about $1.2 million. John Casperson is the maritime lawyer representing the McClintons.
The vessel was put up by as collateral by its owner in exchange for some financing that was advanced, and the payments were not made. And so when that happens, then the lender comes to me and says, we need to recover on our collateral to try to satisfy our debt.
Casperson says if the court proceedings go forward in the normal course, the Atlantis will be sold by the federal marshals at an auction.
A new buyer then would take ownership of the barge and then use it for whatever purpose they choose to do so. Obviously, it'd be interested in seeing it stay in Southeast, but you never know what the new buyer might have in mind for it.
It is possible, says Casperson, that the McClintons could purchase the barge at the auction, but it is an auction and there are no guarantees. He says the next thing that will likely happen in the courts is that other parties with financial interests regarding the Atlantis will make their concerns known to the courts.
At this point, people that have an interest in the barge or a claim to the barge, a lien or any sort, then they have the right for the next period, a short period of time, to file those claims with the court, so that their interest can also be considered as part of this process.
Perhaps complicating this story is that despite being a plaintiff in these court proceedings, David McClinton's name also appears in various documents in which he is described as a managing member of Astoria Seafoods, the defendant in these proceedings. McClinton's name also appears on a check made out to the city of Craig. The business name on the check is Cossex in Alaska, which is also mentioned throughout the court papers. Attorney John Casperson says he cannot speak to those relationships at this point. He says the next court proceedings have not yet been scheduled. At this time, two Craig entities are listed as being owed money related to the Atlantis. $60,000 is owed to Alaska Power and Telephone. The city of Craig is owed $50,000. John Bowling, city administrator for Craig, says the first year the Atlantis came to town, it did bring a large crew which spent money in town. Some locals were also employed and raw fish tax was generated. But things didn't go well this past summer. In fact, things didn't go at all. The crew showed up but eventually left. No fish was processed. Eventually, the Atlantis was towed to Ketchikan. Bowling says under the terms of the lease, the Atlantis is required to process seafood.
If they don't, then there's a cash payment that's due to the city of Craig. And so because the company didn't process fish in 2008 and may not have processed enough in 2007 to meet the goals mandated under the lease, then we'll have, the city's going to have to take that issue up with the company as a tenant before the coming salmon season.
Bowling says it is the city's hope that the barge will return in time for next summer's salmon fishing. I'm Jay Marble.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, John Ryan in Juneau, and Jake Marble in Craig. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Gooseberry Peter is our audio engineer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. And by
the Anchorage Convention and Visitors Bureau. Anchorage offers big wild adventures all year long. You can explore online at anchorage.net/stay, your source for winter event information.
Support for APRN coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood comes from Penn Air, offering scheduled charter services throughout Alaska and the United States. Miss our newscast today? Listen to APRN's Alaska Morning News, Economic Report, and News Nightly on the web at aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.